Yeah. Discover yourself. Well, the first question to ask if we want to discover ourselves is, who are we? Who are you? Who am I? Often people ask me, how are you? They probably ask you the same thing also. It's a very commonly asked thing. I usually reply by saying, who am I? That's a more important question. Mostly people don't think, who am I? It's obvious. Who am I? Well, in my passport there's such and such a name. It gives, you can look it up on the internet probably, the name, the age, the place of birth, present occupation, marital status, sex, sexual orientation. They didn't used to think about that, but that's become an issue in the modern age. So it's clear who you are. But not so very clear if you think about it a little more, because this figure which is connected with the body, the personality that's connected with the body, well, one thing's for sure, and you don't have to be a big philosopher to understand this, that the body's going to die. Right? Anyone got any problem with that? I mean, you all, it's understandable, right? The body is going to die. You could argue against it if you want, as this is the problem with the problem in logic, that you can't actually prove it. You can't actually prove that man is mortal, because you never know. You might find someone who never dies. It hasn't happened yet in the history of the human race, but it's not sure that someone's going to die until they die. According, if you take it from the human perspective instead of the perspective of realized knowledge. Anyway, this body's going to die. You may say, well, it didn't die yet, so there's no surety that we'll die, but we are sure. How are we sure? Well, how can you be sure? Any suggestions? But that doesn't mean it'll happen to you. If it hasn't happened yet, how can you be sure it's going to happen in future? Okay, but it still doesn't, it's no proof that you're going to die. It's no proof that, there's no proof that the body will die until it dies, which means as long as it's alive, there's no surety that it's going to die. Of course, we think it's sure. I'm not really making a case that we won't die, but I'm just asking, what's the proof? The proof is, jātasya hi janma mṛtyu. Jātasya hi dhruva mṛtyu, dhruvaṁ janma mṛtasya cha. Because Krishna said in Bhagavad Gita, that's the proof. Actually, we accept. There's no proof otherwise. From the human platform, there's no proof. This in Sweden, you may remember that Srila Prabhupada was talking with an Indian doctor, I believe it was, and the doctor asked him, what is the proof of the soul? And Prabhupada said, because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. And the doctor was very skeptical. That's the actual proof from our platform on this. What are we? We're tiny little beings on a tiny little planet. And we live for a blip in time. If you sneeze, well, in terms of eternity, our lifespan is not much more than a sneeze. So we're very tiny living beings. How can we know for sure? Well, we accept what is knowledge coming from beyond time and space. That is the knowledge of the Vedas. Veda means knowledge, real knowledge. So anyway, whether we take the knowledge from Krishna in Bhagavad Gita or whether we just accept that we're all going to die, the fact is that this body is going to die. But I am not the body. That's very good news. This body is not me. Good thing to understand. What do you think? We understand I'm not the body. I'm not chemicals. If we analyze the body, okay, have we got anyone who remembers their biology lessons? What's in the body? Mostly, there's a lot of nothing, actually, because that's the atoms are mostly nothing, according to what we learn in science. It's mostly all nothing, right? It's like a big universe with a few subatomic particles floating around. So anyway, there's supposed to be plenty of carbon and nitrogen and oxygen. There's a little gold in there too, although I wouldn't bother killing anyone to try to extract it, because the extraction process, even to find it, would be difficult. In modern life, there's probably more lead than there should be, and other more mercury and all these kind of things. Probably people who eat at Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's, there's probably some styrofoam in there also. There's a bunch of chemicals, but I am not chemicals. What do you think? One man comes up to a beautiful young woman and says, "Oh, I love the combination of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen. Your chemicals are so attractive." Or you may say, "Well, I wasn't very good in love life. I couldn't make it, so I'll just get some carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen and mix them all up, and then I love it." But you can't love a bunch of chemicals. People are attracted to not to the chemicals. In modern life especially, there's so much emphasis on sexual attraction. Even in, what's that paper called, Asian Voice or something like that, we were taking prasadam, and even there on that paper, which is supposed to, it's mostly for Gujaratis, is it? Asian Voice, and then Acharya Prabhu turned it up the other way. I was wondering why he was doing it, because there are so many revealing pictures of pretty Asian Gujarati, or I don't know what, young women. So it's everywhere. They're showing the bodies because it's supposed to be very attractive. There's so much emphasis on sex. But if we offer someone, "Here you are, I'm going to give you the girl of your dreams, beautiful hair, beautiful eyes, beautiful skin, beautiful figure, absolutely gorgeous and beautiful. There's only one problem. What's that? She's dead." Who will like to embrace? You're getting excited. "Really? Really? She's dead. She just died." So then all the attraction you feel, all of a sudden you feel repulsion, because we're not attracted to the body. We're attracted to the soul that makes the body. "I am not the body. I am eternal. I am not chemicals." So this is the real discovering yourself. When you see this given, discover yourself. And I suppose when people read this, they think they're going to discover the genius within them. Mostly everyone thinks the genius is within them, but mostly they're not. Everyone tends to overestimate themselves. Or we may think, everyone has so much hidden potential and how you can become a success in the world, but what's the point ultimately? In my personal travels around the world in the matter of speaking this understanding of Krishna consciousness, I meet so many people. You go in some remote village in some country which probably most people never heard of, and you find someone in the village and everyone's looking up to him and he's a very big, proud man. But he's in the world scene, he's nothing. Or you find in a village in Bangladesh or Philippines or someone comes home from working in Dubai. They're very prestigious because they work in Dubai and they get lots of money. In Dubai, they're just the bottom of society. They're a toilet cleaner. But when they come home, because they're working overseas and earning lots of money, they're, very, very prestigious. It's all nonsense, this whole idea of being a big man. Even if you become as big a man as David Cameron, so what? also, thou dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. The body is made of chemicals, and it will revert back into the earth. And you may think, well, my name will go down in history. So what? So what? It'll be forgotten in the course of history also. So the whole idea of trying to be a big man, or we have to say in the modern age, a big woman also, because we have to sound not as if we're discriminatory. A big person. Okay, a big person. All right. Non-sexist language. The whole idea of being a big person in this world, it's ridiculous. It's silly. But then who actually are, what's it all about? What are we doing here anyway? Why are we here? There are many possible answers to that question, and the main answer which most people give is answer by negation. In other words, they don't take any interest in it whatsoever. They think that, well, we're just here and just enjoy life. As long as you're here, enjoy life. There's even an Indian philosopher, ancient philosopher, who also recommended that. Rinang kritva gritang pibet yavat jivat sukham jivat. That is the essence of the Charvaka philosophy. As long as you are alive, enjoy yourself. Because bhasmi bhutasya dehasya king puna agavano bhavet. He said that anyway, when you die, the body is burned and you won't come back again. So enjoy yourself as long as you can. And he particularly recommended by getting ghee, because he must have been a high-class atheist. Well, in those days, I guess everyone ate ghee. People weren't eating sunflower oil. So, as long take ghee and be happy. Eat good food, that was his idea. Epicurean, that's the idea. Enjoy life. Well, actually, the original Epicureans weren't what we nowadays call Epicureans. But the idea is enjoy life. Just don't bother about any meaning of life. Just as long as you live, be happy. But a person who is more thoughtful won't be satisfied with this. Is there really so much happiness in eating good food? Is there really so much happiness in the modern context, going to parties and doing exercise so that on the few sunny days a year in England you can walk around with your chest open, if you're a male, and show off your big strong body, and then that's what you get, right? You can put tattoos all over your chest, and then on 3 or 4 days a year you can walk around showing it. Or now the fashion is to put it on the back, right? And then they have it's cut out at the back so you can show that you have tattoos on your back. Is there more to life than this childish showing yourself to be something tough or strong because you sat while you were being tattooed? So, what is the answer? The answer we can't get simply by wondering about it. But we can take the answer from spiritually realized persons who know. And fortunately, not unfortunately, and fortunately, the answer is a very encouraging answer. What is the purpose of life? If we are to discover ourselves, what will we find? The answer is that the meaning of life is to love. But not exactly love as we call it in this world. Love means just like that. A man loves a beautiful woman. Generally, men don't fall in love with old women. They fall in love with a young woman. And they don't fall in love with dead young women also. They're attracted to the body. What they call love, it develops on the basis of the body. But the body is temporary. So real love must be eternal. And real love is also selfless. That means when real love means giving, not getting. In this world, everyone wants to get from everyone else. Either by working and earning some money, they get something from them, or by exploitation. If someone becomes in a strong position, then they exploit. If they have the opportunity, they exploit others. That's what they say. Power corrupts. That means someone may be good as long as they don't have the opportunity to be bad. But when they have the opportunity, they'll take the opportunity and exploit others. But love means not to try to exploit, but to give, to serve. And therefore, persons like Mother Teresa are very much, well, when you say persons, well, maybe there aren't that many persons like her, because she seems that she wanted to just give, give, give. But then she was serving the bodies. Her emphasis was on serving different bodies, and the body has to die. So real love is love beyond the body. Understanding that the body is temporary, but the soul which gives the body life, that is the life. The body dies, but the soul continues to exist. Before I was in this body, I was alive. I didn't come into existence with the existence of this body, which is just come and gone in a second. We're eternally existing. And we go on and on, getting body after body after body, until we find that real love that we're searching for. We're actually searching for that in life after life. We're looking for happiness. Every living being is looking for happiness. Is it not? What do you think? Even the plant tries to grow toward the sunlight. As he finds there's something good for me there. But when we understand that we're not the body, we understand that the benefit of my body is not the ultimate benefit for me, because I'm not the body. However much we exercise the body and take health foods and take life insurance policies and all this. I always think it's a funny name, life insurance policies. It's actually for death. It's death insurance, isn't it? But there's no... When you die, as long as you're alive, you don't get it. But when you die, then you still don't get it, but your relatives are supposed to get it. So we can try to however much we try to decorate the body in various ways, the body has to die, but I will continue to exist eternally. So to first point to discover yourself is to understand this body is not me, I am eternal. The real me exists beyond this body. And what are we actually looking for? In all that we're doing, in every species of life, what are we looking for? We're looking for happiness, and real happiness is in love. But love is not love of the body, or love related with the body. The body is only chemicals. So real love is spiritual. Spiritual means on the platform, beyond the body. Usually this point, which I just mentioned, that we're not the body, we get body after body after body. Here in the Western countries, it seems to be very difficult for people to understand. It's a cultural thing, at least among Hindus in general, in India. Even though there's no proper education in this, but because there's some kind of understanding in the culture, then they can accept it. I was raised in England, in this lifetime, in a culture where there was no, at that time, there was no widespread concept of reincarnation. But in my early teens, when I started to think about it, I thought, oh, I got a whole life to live ahead of me. I don't want to be like all these people all around me. Just what are they living for? What are they living? What, do I have to be like that? And then thinking, then then I heard this idea that you get born again. I thought, yeah, well, that seems to make a lot of sense, because the way I'm going, I'm not going to work things out in this lifetime. So if I get another chance, that would be better. And also the whole idea of God throwing you in hell forever. I thought that was horrible. What a horrible religion. God throws you in hell forever and looks down and laughs as you're burning in hell. So that was horrible. But then the idea of God who gives you, you may make a mistake or many mistakes in one lifetime, but then you get another chance, and then another chance, and then another chance. I thought, whew, yeah, okay. We can accept God as being merciful if he gives us many chances, but if he only gives you one chance, and then, whew, it sounds horrible, like we've been created to suffer eternally. So, it's often very difficult for people to understand this, and in general in the culture, they don't want people to understand this, because the whole culture is just, it's a consumer culture, so get money, spend it, enjoy, and don't think. You work hard, earn money, spend it, get into debt, that's even better. And then you have to go on working and working to pay it off, and just going after money, 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 and nothing for the soul. No thought. Don't think too deeply about anything. Well, you can think about science or something like that, a few bit, but to consider, who am I? Why am I suffering in this world? Why do I have to die? What happens after death? No one likes to think about these questions, or if they do, they tend to give very shallow answers. So, the first thing is, it's often a very, very big step for people to understand that we're not this body, we're taking birth again and again and again. But over and beyond that, the point that life is meant for love. And love in this world, that's not pure love, because it always results in suffering. Either the person you thought they loved you, and you found that they don't love you, or they die, which plunges you in suffering. So love in this world is not eternal, it causes suffering, it's never complete. Real love is on a platform beyond birth and death. When we get free from birth and death, we can go to the spiritual world, where the central object of love is Krishna. Krishna means the all-attractive, all-loving person who is known in the English language by the word God, but the word God in the English language is a very poor, because they don't have knowledge of God, so it gives a very poor impression. It doesn't really give a right idea. I was told you're from Poland. What's the word Bóg, is it, for God in Polish? Something like that? Bóg. Bóg, yeah. So in Sanskrit, the word for God is Bhagavan. So you can see it's related. All the languages actually come from Sanskrit. So Bhagavan means God. That's the name of the position. And the personal name is Krishna. Just like here in this country, the position of Prime Minister, it's a post, is held by the person David Cameron. So if you say Prime Minister, if you see a photo of a certain person, you say, that's the Prime Minister, that's correct. And if you, the same person, if you say, that's David Cameron, that's correct. So both, but it's a different perspective. One is saying, what is his position? The other is saying, what is the person? Of course, the position stays the same, but the person occupying doesn't change it. But in the case of God, there are no elections, and he doesn't die, so he's always God. And his name is Krishna. Now, that's an important distinction, because often people think that God, well, God is just some light, or God is just some force, or God is so mighty we can't understand him properly. Mostly people don't have any idea of who, they have some idea there's some God, but they don't really know who he is. But we who are aspiring devotees of Krishna, we tend to say Krishna more than God. It's a very personal relationship. It's just like most people, if they see David Cameron, I have nothing for or against, you know, I'm not making any political stance here, I'm just using it as an example. I wish him all the best, I have nothing against him, and nothing for him in particular either. So most people, if they see him, they think, oh, that's the Prime Minister. But when his wife sees him, or his mother sees him, saying, oh, that's my son, or my... It's a very personal relationship. So we often speak of God or Bhagavan when we're speaking about him in terms of his position. But generally we use the term Krishna, because we are trying to revive our eternal personal relationship with Krishna, who is the central object of all love, is Krishna. Now, if we think about a big man in this world, again we can use the example of David Cameron, that if you wanted to meet him, it would be very difficult, isn't it? If any of us in this room said, well, I'd like to meet David Cameron, it's not impossible, but almost, because we're not important enough people. Actually, all of you are much more important in terms of spiritual understanding and progress. But it'd be very difficult to meet him, because he's only one man and he has a very big job, and he tends to meet with people who are big people in the world, and he discusses things with them like that. And even if you met him, you might be able to shake his hand and have a photo taken, and that would be it. But if you thought, well, I'd like to get very close to him, have a personal relationship, that's really practically impossible. Why? Because he's only one person, and he can only deal with a limited number of people. But because Krishna is Bhagavan, which means he's God, he's the supreme person, but he's also unlimited. That means that even though he's a person, he's not limited in the number of relationships he can have. He personally relates with every person. Every one of us can have a complete, loving, direct, personal relationship with the Supreme Person, who's not only the Supreme Powerful, he's also the Supreme Beautiful, Supreme Merciful, Supreme Loving. That is Krishna. So we are developing a loving relationship with Krishna. There's this very beautiful painting here of the devotee who goes back to the spiritual world and meets Krishna, and Krishna embraces him personally. Can you imagine that people are praying to God, bowing down to him, give me this, give me that, give me something else. In a war, the troops on one side are praying to God, help us kill the enemy. And on the other side, they're also praying to God, help us kill the enemy. So they're both praying to kill the other party. But Krishna, God himself, he's the Supreme Person. And being a person, a real person, a developed person, isn't interested in just exploiting others, and giving orders to them. He likes to be close to others. So Krishna likes that also. And therefore Krishna expands himself into unlimited living beings who he wants to live with and love and embrace and play with and dance and eat with and joke around with. That is God. That is Krishna. So to discover ourself means to discover that we are eternal and our eternal relationship with Krishna, which is real. This body, well, we can say it's real, but how real is it? In another few years, this particular body will say it's not real. In fact, how is it real? Because it's always changing. The body, as soon as you look at this, and even the time it takes you to see it, the time it takes you to see it and process it within our brain, what we saw has already changed. So it's very difficult to see. There's a sense of continuity in time. But actually, what we see, it's no longer there. It's already changed. And definitely this body will change. There are changes of the body. There's birth. In Sanskrit, there are two terms for birth. One's garbhastha, that means to be the embryos formed in the womb. And then bhumistha, that means to come out of the womb. So that's why in India traditionally, if you say someone, how old are you? They may say 70, but in the Western reckoning it would be 69, because the first birthday is when they come out. That's actually the first birthday, isn't it? And they're already 10 months in the womb. 10 months? 10 months? Well, it's 10 months if we take by the lunar calendar. So they say 10 months in the womb. So there's birth and then growing up. And then we remain steady for some time. Then this body also produces byproducts in the form of children and also in the form of urine, stool, pus, perspiration. The body goes through this change, and the body, it winds down and then it dies. But the person continues to exist. And after the inevitable death of this body, I will continue to exist. So the body is not really real in the full sense of the term. It's real, but it's real just like the pattern in a kaleidoscope. It's there for 1 second and gone. But what is really real is eternal. And what is eternal is our loving relationship with Krishna. So to discover ourself really means to discover our eternal relationship with Krishna. And if we understand this, then we automatically we cross over all the difficulties of this world. Of course, as long as we're in this world, there will be various difficulties. The main ones which are pointed out in Bhagavad Gita are janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi, birth, death, old age and disease. Further analyzed as adhyatmik, adhibhautik, adhidaivik, klesh, different kinds of misery we have to suffer. Miseries that are produced from the body, just like pains in the knees or cough in the throat. Miseries produced in the mind, anxiety, tension, hatred. If we hate others, it also hurts ourselves. Love, that's also a big problem in this world. So all these problems are produced in the mind. So we have problems produced by our body and our mind. Problems created by others. Apart from other humans creating problems for us, there are, definitely in India, we often experience problems from mosquitoes, for instance. And it's very common at night in the cities to be kept awake by barking dogs. So other living beings cause us problems. And there are also what we call natural disturbances, which means they're produced by the demigods who are overseeing the affairs of the universe. Too much heat, too much cold, too much rain, not enough rain, typhoons, earthquakes, tsunamis, and so on. These are natural disturbances. So in the Vedic literature, there's a very deep analysis of the nature of this world and the nature of our psychological incarceration within it, just to convince us that we don't belong to this world, and that if we link our consciousness with Krishna, then even though we have to live in this world, just like you might have noticed, it's not a major problem, but I have at present a minor problem of a cough and my voice is a little down. So I have to live with it. I mean, say, well, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, so why have I got a cough? Well, as long as we're in this world, we're going to have coughs and colds and sore knees and sleeplessness sometimes, or sometimes too much sleepiness. We may have financial problems, legal problems, personal problems, social relationship problems. As long as we're in this world, we're going to have this kind of problem. But by understanding that really I don't have anything directly to do with this, then automatically, by understanding, by cultivating our eternal loving relationship with Krishna, then we experience that in this very life, the happiness that comes from the loving relationship with Krishna. We understand that I shouldn't get too much upset by things that are going on in this world, because anyway, it's all temporary and I don't have anything really to do with it. That doesn't mean that we become neglectful to it. As long as we're in, for instance, we might think, well, really I have nothing to do with this world, so anyway, I'll just cross the road without looking, because anyway, I don't belong to this world. And then you get hit by a car and it hurts and you have to go to hospital and you cause problems for others. So you should live responsibly in this world, but also understand that I don't belong to this world. My real self is not a product of this world. I don't belong in this world. As long as we identify with this world, we have to live in it, birth after birth after birth. As long as we put our hopes in this world that I can be happy here, then we keep on trying. We come back again and again and again. But if we understand that our eternal true position is in the spiritual world with Krishna, and we cultivate that by the process of bhakti yoga, chanting Hare Krishna, then after leaving this body, tyaktva dehang punarajanma naiti mam eti sojana, we can go to Krishna and be embraced by Krishna eternally. So, in this way we become relieved from tension and anxiety and build self-confidence and relate better to others. Simple techniques. What is the simple technique? Well, the first thing is just understanding that I'm not this body, and then immediately get rid of most of your tension and anxiety, which comes from identifying ourselves with the situation that we're presently in. Self-confidence comes from understanding that I'm totally insignificant. And usually we think self-confidence comes from, yes, well, I'm very important. But when we understand that I'm not important, it's not a matter of opinion, it's just a fact. We're not important. We may say, let's say Barack Obama. I said David Cameron enough. Yeah, well, he's very important. Yeah, maybe, a little bit. Just in a blip of time, he seems to be very important. But we get self-confidence not from artificially thinking that I'm very important, but from understanding that even though I am very, 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 very to the power of, how many times you want to put it, to the power of infinity, I'm very unimportant, but Krishna loves me. And I've got nothing to, I have no motive to try to exploit others or harm others. And so I can live in this world confident that no one can harm me. Ultimately, no one can harm me. And with the confidence of knowing what I'm living this world and what I'm living for. And we can relate better to others because we're no longer trying to cut a profile of trying to show ourselves to be something that we're not. We just act naturally in the sense that, yeah, we're neither trying to show someone that we're better than them or, just live in this world peacefully, chant Hare Krishna, and understand that every living being is also related to Krishna. So love for Krishna means love for all living beings. So that's it, in brief. Discover yourself. It might take many lifetimes, or it can be in this lifetime also. There's a process to understand. That process is by, first of all, if we're to understand who we are, we have to lead a pure life. We can't develop spiritual realization if we're smoking, drinking alcohol, having sex left, right and center, and so on. We have to be focused and clear and pure. We have to lead a pure life. So that's a must. You can't be a yogi and a bhogi at the same time. Bhogi, that sounds like Bhagavan, doesn't it? But it means someone who's an enjoyer of this world. And actually the word Bhagavan means the enjoyer of everything. He's the one who should enjoy. But if we try to become God, then we can't understand that we're a servant of God. So we should be a yogi. And yogi also doesn't mean that we should deny the body. Here's today's lunch. Half a carrot. That's it. That's today. One meal a day. Well, some people can live on that. But in general, it's recommended by Krishna himself. Yukta ahara viharasya, yukta cheshtasya karmasu, yukta svapnava bodhasya, yogo bhavati dukaha. That a yogi can overcome all the miseries of the world by practicing yoga in this way. By taking food in moderation, by all activities in moderation, work, then recreation or relaxation, everything in moderation. It's a big topic, but it is possible. It is whatever background we're from, we can immediately plug in. Yoga means to join together. We can join together with Krishna by this process of bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion. I know, myself, when I first was admitted into this movement, in those days we didn't have any idea that, okay, you start off with run round and then gradually do two rounds. No, one bit, okay, 16 rounds, immediately. I was looking around and thought, well, I didn't know anything about this. And immediately you have to chant Hare Krishna with beads for 2 hours or so. I thought, how can I do it? Then I looked around me, I saw all these people. They're all, none of them were from any extra, all similar background as myself. None of some of them might have come directly from the spiritual world, but at least in my vision at that time, they're ordinary people like me. And they're chanting Hare Krishna, so I can also chant Hare Krishna. That's what I thought. If they can do it, I guess I can do it also. So I also started chanting 16 rounds of the Hare Krishna mantra every day. And it's actually very blissful. It's quite amazing if you think about it, how we get up every morning and we chant Hare Krishna. And it's Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. It's short, there are three words, and we just say it over and over again. And you think, well, you, You get fed up of it after Sunday, but we don't. We find it very blissful. It's very pleasing to chant the names of Krishna. And we start every day enthusiastically singing the names of Krishna. Well, that's proof in itself that it's spiritual, isn't it? Because there's no material name. Even if there's some song that you like very much, if you sing it again and again and again, you're going to get fed up of it. And it might take a few hours if it's a really good song. But can you imagine if you had to... That might be considered one form of torture, just to play the same song again and again and again. But this is not torture. It's actually blissful to chant the names of Krishna every day. And we feel such pleasure in chanting the names of Krishna. That's spiritual pleasure. If it was a material sound, we couldn't sing it again and again. But because it's completely spiritual sound, which is imbued with all the potency of Krishna. Nam nam akari bahuda nija sarva shaktis tatra pita niyamita smarnena kala. Ita drishi tava kripa bhagavan mama pitur daiva mi drishami hajani nanu raga. This name of Krishna is Krishna. He has so many names, and every name is Krishna. The name is Krishna. And imbued with all Krishna's spiritual potencies, there are not even hard and fast rules for chanting. That means that we don't have to consider astrologically the correct time or see if which place is purified. Just any time, any place, we can start chanting Hare Krishna. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in humility says he has no taste for that. But actually it's very blissful, isn't it? Often people ask me, how long have you been in this Hare Krishna movement? And I tell them, well, it's 40 years now. And I say, well, are you happy? I say, well, if I wasn't happy, I wouldn't be doing it, would I? No one comes with a gun in the morning and says, get up and chant Hare Krishna. It used to be something like that. But not nowadays. Maybe those days were better. We used to call it fanaticism. But, if I didn't like it, I wouldn't do it. But there's something there. I mean, you may say, have you made any progress? I don't know about progress, but I like it. It's something very nice, very pleasurable. When I see my life, I think, well, I'm very happy. Some years ago, I was... I was going on a train from Victoria to Gatwick. I was taking a flight to somewhere, I can't remember where. And I going through South London and seeing all these houses. There was some ritzy part with some yachts parked outside. I looked and I thought, thank you so much, Srila Prabhupada, for saving me. I could have been like that also. Krishna saved me from all that. Gave me this. Actually, a very blissful life, chanting Hare Krishna, associating with saintly people. You're all very saintly people. You have all no meat, no fish, no eggs, no... Of course, in your background, you never had that. Maybe onions, I don't know. Maybe not, but to come out of that, meat, fish, eggs, and going to cinemas, and all useless things, and just dedicate the life for chanting Hare Krishna and associating with saintly persons and trying to bring Krishna to others. This is very saintly life. We're very fortunate to have the company of people who they want to live a godly life. How many people in the modern world want to live a godly life? Even if you say it, people say, oh, godly, what is he talking about? Sounds something strange. It doesn't sound quite right. So we're very fortunate to be in the association of saintly people, chanting Hare Krishna, discussing really important things. If people come together, there's this social pressure that you have to talk, you have to say something. So in England, they talk about the weather. In Bengal, they talk about the state of your digestion and your stool. It's their culture. It's just like in England, the weather's different every day. So in Bengal, your stool is different every day. Gives you something to talk about. So, but people have to talk about something. Or they invent these things like football, and then it gives them something to talk about. They're just wasting their time. And cricket. I saw it just outside your house. The young, look like Indian boy playing cricket. So the English boys, they play football, but the Indian boys, they play cricket, right? They stick to their own culture. So, introduced by the British. So, we have this tendency to talk, and people talk all useless things, and if they don't have anything to talk about, then they make all these. Most of the news in the paper, what is it? It's about sports and about film stars and TV stars, their latest divorce and this and that. It's all nonsense. But devotees come together and they discuss about Krishna and about the meaning of life and how we can bring Krishna to others. Very, very saintly company. Even though we all have our struggles, no doubt, we all have our. It's not that we're all becoming perfect overnight, but just the endeavor to live a saintly life and to chant the holy names of Krishna. That in itself is. We're all very fortunate to have the association of each other, so that we can chant Hare Krishna together and endeavor together to go to Krishna and be embraced by Krishna in the spiritual world. And we can feel here also how Krishna is embracing us, isn't it? If we give ourselves to Krishna, we'll feel Krishna's embrace. Hare Krishna. So, suppose we're supposed to finish at 6:30 and have prasad. You must be all really hungry after having that light snack at midday. We could go on a bit longer, couldn't we? Oh, is it? Tomorrow is 6:30. Yeah. 7:30. Whatever. We can go on as we like because it's relatively early. It was advertised in the original sheet for this. There'd be questions and answers. So I guess we could have questions and I'm supposed to give the answers. Yes. At this stage, you should be giving answers, not asking questions. Although you can go on asking questions. You find even the four Kumaras ask questions to Lord Brahma. So, it's not forbidden, but at this stage, you should be giving more answers than questions. 7:30, okay, fine. So we go on with questions and answers, then we can have more kirtan. Yeah, please. Yeah.
And as we know, Prabhupada mentions several places in his literature, but sometimes it translates a little different. I'm thinking about the Tathagatani on the Paranayana. And the most common translation, of course, is no heart of first gurus to chant the whole name.
Yeah.
So how can we understand that there's one word in Sanskrit, the Sanskrit of Prabhupada, which is another word in translation?
And there's one word in the Sanskrit, and sometimes Srila Prabhupada used different words in the translation. Well, as in practically all languages, especially those which are more sophisticated, many words have more than one meaning. Also, a common system of translation or explanation, just like we have Srila Prabhupada's translations and purports. What Srila Prabhupada called purport in English is often, actually if you translate that back to Sanskrit, it comes out as tatparya. But the commentary, well, there are different words for that also, bhasha, tika, but commonly it's given as bhavarth, which means bhava means feeling, and artha means meaning. So the commentary is sometimes called bhavarth, which means it gives the meaning and the intention also. Because when some instruction is given, it's not just a set of laws, but there's some intention, some meaning. There may be some subtle meaning there also. The Srila Prabhupada's translations, they're often non-literal. They might leave out some of the Sanskrit, or they might add something in also. So that's common. That's common among translators or those who explain. That's one of the important meanings of parampara, actually, that each acharya adds or has the right to add his own realization coming from Krishna. It doesn't change. He presents Shastra, but with some different, may have some different perspective, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is recorded as saying that Krishna Tula Bhagavat Bibhu Sharbashray Prati Shloke Prati Akare Nana Artha Koi. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that Srimad Bhagavatam is totally comparable to Krishna in being all-powerful and able to give shelter to others. In every verse and in every syllable there are various meanings. Now this this particular line which you quoted, that's explained in the, if you see the last chapter, Antya Lila chapter 20, I believe it is, of Chaitanya Charitamrita, which the main subject is the Shikshashtaka prayers. It describes again the ecstasies of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu at night with Sarup, Damodar, and Ramananda Rai. And then the last part of the chapter is the given, in each verse is given a summary of each chapter. And then he finishes up the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita with offering obeisances again to all the gurus. So the main subject is the Shikshashtaka prayer. So the prayer is given in Sanskrit, and then again it's explained in Bengali verse. So in that particular part, Niyamitas, what is that? Niyamitas Smarane Nakala. That is described in Bengali verse that Kayate Shuite Jota Tota Namaloi Desha Kala Niyam Nahi Sarva Siddhi Hoy, which means that kayate, by when eating, shuite, when lying down, sleeping, jata tata namlo, in whatever circumstance or whatever manner one takes the holy name. In Bengali, it's given as taking the holy name. To chant the holy names means to take the holy name. Deshkal, there's niyam. There's no rules. Deshkal niyam nahi. There's no rule concerning time or place. But in whatever way one takes the name, sarva siddhi hoy, one can attain full perfection. So that's the translation of that. Now there's also, there are also considerations for chanting. It doesn't mean that it's a complete free-for-all. There's also consideration of attitude in chanting. That means it's not like, for instance, if one has to perform a Vedic yajna, there are many, many rules, and practically none of them can be fulfilled in the modern age. First of all, to have a Vedic yajna, you'd have to have Vedic brahmanas. But as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has elaborately analyzed in his book, which is called in short, Brahmana O Vaishnava. There are no Vedic Brahmanas in the modern age because the purity hasn't been maintained. At least there's no surety, at very least you can say. So there's consideration of place and time. You have to calculate astronomically You have to have proper brahmanas. The time has to be calculated. The place has to be pure. But there's no place in the whole world which is pure. There are sinful activities going on everywhere, even in the holy places. In fact, we find in the holy places, there are often more sinful activities than in other places. Sorry to say. You can still find holy people there, but there are many unholy people who go there to exploit the sentiments of others. So those rules don't apply, but it doesn't mean that you can just say Hare Krishna and just by saying it mechanically that one will get all perfection. In whatever way one chants, there'll be some benefit. But there is also consideration of nama aparada. So if one chants offensively, then the result, one may get an opposite result. Or the result may take a very long time. So that's why it's also required, along with chanting, to hear and understand all these things. The attitude is essential. In the verse prior to, just following that is Trinadapi Sunicha. That Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after saying that there's no rule in chanting, immediately after that, he says to Srupa Damodaran Ramananda Raito, Ki Rupe Nam Loile Premu Pajoy Taha Lokon Shuno Srup Ramrai. He says that in which manner one should take the holy name so that prem, love of Krishna, will arise. Here are the characteristics of that Srup Damodaran Rai Ramananda. That means that even though he just said that there are no rules, but at the same time there are some considerations, which also suggests that if we don't chant with those considerations, that there won't be an arising of prema. And then that brings us to the next verse. Trinadapi sunichena tarari vasahishrana amanina amanadena kirtaniya sadaharihi. If one chants Hare Krishna, but is not cultivating a mood of humility, then we won't get the result of chanting Hare Krishna. Because chanting Hare Krishna means to pray, Krishna, please engage me in your service. But if we're not humble, then it's just a mockery. So we don't get, it's not real. We're not really praying to Krishna. We don't get the result. So there's a whole science of chanting the holy name. When I say science, it means the attitude. And there are some considerations of technique also, because when we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're also doing for the pleasure of Krishna. Everything should be done for the pleasure of Krishna. That is love. So some considerations are to chant the name clearly. If we don't chant clearly, it doesn't show much love. If we don't, we don't even take the trouble to pronounce someone's name very clearly. And if we're going to sing and play music, well, we shall try to do so in a musical way. Not that music is our aim and our goal and our essence, but it's done for the pleasure of Krishna. So we should try to do so in a musically pleasing way, as far as possible. The main thing is the attitude. But then if our attitude is to please Krishna, then we should also try to please, sing in a pleasing way. There actually, it's a whole science of kirtan. Srila Prabhupada didn't teach us much. We could try to imbibe more of it. There are also considerations of which tunes to sing at the time of day. Just like yesterday, you were singing and I told you it's the wrong tune for the time of day. I don't know if you ever heard of such a thing before. But certain tunes, they complement the psychic atmosphere at the time of day. And there are certain tunes in different seasons, and it's a whole science of music. So that is secondary, but it's not unimportant. In all the Vedic arts, cooking, dressing, painting, they're all ultimately meant for the pleasure of Krishna. So Srila Prabhupada, he also said this movement is meant for cultural conquest, that this is a different culture overcoming the West. So actually it's a very developed culture, and that can be one of the aims of the Krishna Consciousness Movement, to revive that culture, very sophisticated culture. Here in the West, especially in England and America, people think that this is the culture, this is the best culture. But actually a culture that's based on animal killing and drinking alcohol, how can that be developed culture? With no knowledge, no spiritual knowledge whatsoever, nothing, zero. They don't even know the first thing, that the body is temporary, the soul is eternal. So this highly developed culture in so many areas, developed in India, with the ultimate goal that Krishnarthe Kila Cheshta, every endeavor should be for the pleasure of Krishna. So we have this culture of bowing down to the Guru. That's not only in spiritual matters. If you're going to learn to, indirectly, if you're going to learn to play music, if you're going to learn martial arts, whatever it is, you have to have a guru. You have to bow down to the guru. Everything is, the whole culture imbibes that, or inculcates that sense of humility. That whatever ability I may develop, ultimately is by the grace of God, and is meant for His service. So the guru is seen as the representative of God, even in teaching how to kill others in martial arts. But then of course one doesn't kill whimsically. It's there may be a time and a place and a circumstance for that. So many things. So great culture. For chanting the holy names, there's no time. One can and one should learn to chant in all circumstances. Offer everything to Krishna. So yeah, it can be translated in different ways. Srila Prabhupada himself, he often translated verses differently in different contexts. As it's, you may find a verse quoted, it's quoted just to show a certain point. Just like yesterday I was reading in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, a verse which is quoted to show the principle of cause and effect. Now in the verse that's quoted, it's quoted from a non-devotional drama, Naishad Charit. And it describes about how, what is it, we're living in the heavenly planets, and we get very beautiful bodies by eating food in the mode of goodness in Sattvagun. And in that verse, the effect of eating food in the mode of goodness gives a beautiful body, that's a secondary point. But it's quoted in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita to demonstrate the principle of cause and effect. So it's a very sophisticated culture, no doubt.
You think about the hell's description of that in Christian culture.
In Christian culture, yeah. Srimad Bhagavatam also describes hells, but they're temporary. They're not permanent. As Srila Prabhupada points out in one purport in the fifth canto, some people disbelieve that there's any such place as hell. But there are hellish situations on this earth. Anyone want a ticket for Afghanistan? Well, there are people. They join the British Army and they go off to Afghanistan. They volunteered for that. The hellish situation in that northwest frontier province in Pakistan. And you just any time you can just be walking in the street and then some drone comes and kills you. It's a hellish situation. You're living in fear all the time. Even to some injury can be very, very painful. Toothache. That could, you could think of toothache as being like just your consciousness is completely overcome by suffering. Kidney stones. Anyone ever had kidney stones? Again? Very, very painful. Childbirth before the age of anesthesia, I suppose, is very, very painful. So there is severe pain even on this planet. And what to speak of physical pain, there's the mental pain. There was some painting competition. Srila Prabhupada described it. The competition was to show the look on the face of a mother when she sees her child killed in front of her. Strange subject. And the one which won the prize was of the woman covering her eyes. She couldn't look to see. It's too painful. She didn't personally feel the pain, but the pain of seeing her child. Actually, when the Spanish Inquisition, actually it was the Inquisition came. The Portuguese came to Goa. Then one of their pastimes was cutting off the eyes of parents and killing their children in front of them. It's one of the ways they spread Christianity. So that's hellish, isn't it? People I don't believe there's any hell, but there's hell on this planet. What to speak of some species of life? Imagine being born as a pig. That's like hell, isn't it? Even to be born as a chicken in the modern age, and you're just if male chicken is killed immediately, and the females are just kept tortured all their life, and then brutally killed. So people, they don't believe in hell, but they're making hell for others. People eat a chicken, they think, oh, chicken, well, I don't think anything of it, but that chicken you're eating is, you're participating in the torture and murder of a living being that you never did any harm to you. So people create hell for others, and they make hell for themselves. But the good news is that it's not eternal. There's some punishment which is meant for rectification. And then we get another chance. Whereas in the Christian or Muslim idea, you go to hell forever, there's no chance of ever coming out again. Which to me, in my youth, I thought this is I still think it's a most horrible idea. That there's God who's supposed to be our most kind well-wisher, and the majority of beings he sends to hell forever with no hope of redemption. I recently had a discussion with some Muslims about this. I put this point to them and they couldn't answer it properly. It should come up on the website soon in Bhopal. There was one speaker, and then someone else came and said, here, I'll answer instead. And he said that, well, actually, in the Vedas there's no description of reincarnation, but then they couldn't describe why there's suffering in this world, and therefore they invented this. I told them, this is just your interpretation, it's complete speculation. They really think that reincarnation is a wrong idea, but they said, you shouldn't blame God. I said that, well, if God sends you to hell forever and he's not merciful, I said, we shouldn't blame God. It's your philosophy that's blaming God. The idea of reincarnation is a much better idea, that God gives us many chances. Anyway, it was a first discussion. We may have more, but it's difficult to discuss with them because it doesn't seem to resonate in their heads that if you take person A, if you do something wrong, he punishes you eternally with no hope of redemption. And you take person B, and you do something wrong, and he gives you some punishment, but then he gives you another chance. And as many times as you do something wrong, he'll give you another chance. And he's always ready to help you to come to the right point. So which is a better person? They say person A. Why? Because they're born in that culture. They don't. Most people are just born in some culture and they accept it to be correct. That's all. They don't think very deeply beyond that. In the modern world, people are born in. People are not given any clear idea of anything, and they're just completely confused. And then they take shelter of sex and intoxication, and that's all. And pettiness. Their life revolves around fashions and sports and just petty things. People are confused. So, anything else? Yeah.
What's happening to people who are curious when we do understand why we hear that we're not in law and everything is fine? And we don't need to come back again to understand things. What is happening? Are we going to share?
What happens when we are finally released from this material world? We go to Krishna in the spiritual world. Oh, yeah, we live with Krishna. This world is a reflection of the spiritual world. But it's a perverted reflection. In the spiritual world, there's friends, family, love, playing, working, but not going to factories. Working means taking out cows and no hard work, no. So, it's all fun, but the basis of it is it's all these activities are meant for having loving exchanges. So we remain there eternally, and we don't get bored. There's no boredom in the spiritual world unless you're in the Brahma Jyoti. You get bored, and then you say, "Oh, it's too boring. I think I'll go back to Poland." Something like that. Are we going to see our beloved children? Well, yes, we can see everybody, but we'll see them differently to the way we see them now. How many beloved children have you had?
I've got one.
How many have you had? How many lifetimes have you had?
That's true. Yeah,
there's a story told in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is an encyclopedia of spiritual knowledge in the form of true stories from the past. But the past is also the future, because time goes in circles. That's another misconception in the Christian idea, is that God was sitting on a cloud one day and then he created the world, and then after some time he closes it all up. But rather there's creation, destruction, again and again the world is created, again and again it's destroyed. So there's a story of one king. He couldn't get any children. He was very upset because kings have to have children so that they can, sons especially, so they can train them to be the next king. Then one sadhu, saintly person came and gave him a blessing and said, "You can have a son, but you won't be happy." He said, "Anyway, I'd like to have a son. Let me be happy in having a son." So he got the son. And then his other wives, because especially in those days, kings used to have many wives. The wives of the wives who hadn't given birth, they were envious of the one who had given birth, that she was very happy, and they were unhappy because they weren't having children. And one day they poisoned the child and killed him. So then the king became very unhappy, as the sadhu had predicted. This child will give you unhappiness. So this time the sadhu came back at that time and said, "Well, why are you crying?" He said, "Well, my son died." He said, "Okay, I'll bring him back to life." So by his mystic power, he brought him back to life. And the saint said to him, "Look, here's your father, the king." He said, and the child said, "Which father? I've had so many fathers. I've had thousands and millions of fathers. So we may see our children, but we'll see them differently. We'll see them primarily in their relationship to Krishna rather than the bodily relationship that we had. But one thing is, if you take to Krishna consciousness and you train your children in that, then that relationship can continue in the spiritual world also. But the thing is, we love everyone. But because we're limited in pure consciousness, Krishna consciousness, we love everyone. But we're limited, so we can have relationships with a limited number of living beings. Whereas Krishna, he has unlimited relationships. But if in this world we cultivate spiritual relationships, just like the relationships between all of us here, is not on the basis of the body. It's a relationship in relationship with Krishna. So that will can continue in the spiritual world also. It's not in the spiritual world there are so many people, just like in London there are so many people. You can be completely lonely in the midst of thousands of people. But in the spiritual world there are unlimited number of people, but you don't become lonely because we can relate to everyone. So, Hare Krishna. Yeah, you're going to. Yeah. The spiritual body is the person.
It is not different from the soul.
Yeah, that's correct. The spiritual body is the person. There's no difference. In material consciousness it feels like that, but it's not. But in the spiritual world the spiritual body is the person. How can people do horrible things? This concept of evil is quite prominent in Christian understanding, and even among atheists and agnostics in the modern age, because there's this concept of evil as if it's some kind of outside force. And in Christianity, the devil or Satan has been invented as the promulgator of evil. But it's not actually that there's some outside force called evil. Rather, the real force is love. But when we choose not to love Krishna, then that love becomes perverted into the opposite of love, or dislike, or hatred. And therefore we act, because instead of loving others, we want to use them for our own purposes. We want to exploit them. Therefore, we can do all kinds of horrible things. People become shocked when they see, for instance, or they hear about this Islamic State beheading people and this and that. But the whole of modern civilization is based on torturing other living beings, like cows and chickens and pigs and sheep, and they feel suffering in the same way. So if we have a whole civilization which is based on giving pain to others, we don't even think about it. But that consciousness is, it's going to affect our consciousness. If we're eating meat, then that's going to influence our consciousness. If we can do it to animals, we can do it to humans also. So the basic principle is, instead of loving others, we want to use others for our own sensual enjoyment. In this case, for the sense of taste. And with eating meat, it's not just the taste. There's the feeling that, yeah, I'm becoming very strong by eating another person. Like you've conquered over that other person. You've become dominant over them. So there's an evil mentality in that. So it's not that there's some Satan who's telling us to become evil. It's within us, due to our perverse consciousness. We have to purify that. That becomes pure. That's why we have the, we don't just chant Hare Krishna, we have these talks also, because we have to make decisions. We're all responsible for our decisions. There's good and there's bad. We can't say there's no good and there's, some people say there's no, actually if you're a complete atheist, then ultimately there's no good and there's no bad, because everything's just a bunch of chemicals. And if you say, well, one person killed another, what does that mean? It's like one car smashed into another. If you don't believe there's any spiritual dimension, then why should murder be a crime? Why should there be any crime? Why should there be any right and wrong? You just spoke about murder and rape. Well, if you're an atheist, murder means that one bunch of chemicals, it interfered with the working of another bunch of chemicals, or changed the course of that bunch of chemicals. It's just one chemical matrix working on another chemical matrix. And why should you bother anyway? The very fact that we accept that good and evil, these concepts are metaphysical. But we don't want to admit that. Atheists, they talk about morality, but where is the morality? If there's nothing but chemicals, well, try giving a lecture to a bunch of chemicals. You get one flask of some sulfuric acid and be good, don't do any harm, don't burn others. It's meaningless. It's ridiculous. So there is good and there is bad, and the ultimate arbiter of good and bad is Krishna. We have to act in concord, in accord with Krishna's desires. So if we choose to give suffering to others, then that can expand unlimitedly. In modern societies, they have this tension between the freedom of the individual and then, but how much freedom can you give? Because if you give too much freedom, then people do all wrong things. You have to have laws. If you say, okay, you're free to do whatever you like, okay, then I'll rape my children. You can't do that. Well, I just said, I'm free to do whatever I like. But there have to be laws. And then where do you draw the line? And the person may say, well, I killed all these people, but I want to be free. It's a free country. I shouldn't go to prison. Who decides what's right and what's wrong? The laws are changed according to people's philosophies, as the philosophies change. Just this morning I was talking about how at one time contraception, all the churches said it was sinful. But now most of them, numerically, say that it's acceptable or it's desirable. And prominently the Catholic Church says it's wrong, but most Catholics don't follow that anyway. But the point is that they said it was, most of the, all the churches originally said it was wrong. Now most of them say it's okay. A short time ago, in this country where I was raised, this lifetime, homosexuality was considered something very bad and very wrong. But nowadays, if you say it's very bad and very wrong, you can be put in prison for that. So the laws have, the concept, I'm not making a comment on homosexuality, I'm just making the point that the concept of what is good and bad changes according to people's different ideas. But what is actually good and bad can't change. If it was wrong or right to be a homosexual 100 years ago, then just because we've come 100 years on, it doesn't mean that it's changed being wrong. Either it's wrong or it's right or somewhere in between. But we have our own man-made ideas about what is right and wrong. We can never get it fully right. Therefore, we should follow the instructions, the eternal instructions on how to live in this world, which are given by God in the form of the Vedas. And generally these man-made religions, they can't give any clear understanding. They themselves are confused. So shall we have arati? There was some idea to have arati? Making an offering, okay.